This is Rabbi Josh Uter, and on today's unusually personal Utopia podcast, I'll be talking about the first 6 months of my Aliyah. Wow, it's hard to believe it's been 6 months since I've made Aliyah. My flight from JFK was this past August 11th, landed on the 12th, and officially, my documentation here says, if I'm remembering correctly, that my Aliyah date is the 13th, because after all, it's Israel. Everything depends on paperwork. Normally, I don't do podcasts on my personal life. Haven't written much on my personal life either. Some vague things and some references every now and again. But for the most part, the big things that go on in my life, I just don't write about. Unfortunately, I haven't written that much about anything these days because I've just been too busy. So a podcast, in many respects, is just going to be a whole lot easier. And anyway, I wanted to do a podcast on my experiences so far having made Aliyah. Since I've been here for 6 months, half a year, enough has happened so far that there's what to talk about, with a little more of perspective as opposed to harping on some of the small things that might have otherwise been at the that I've been thinking about, or not thinking about as much as things that it might have happened within, let's say, the first quarter year, which also doesn't have the same ring as it. So why would I want to do this at all? For one, people have been asking me how I am, which is incredibly sweet. So thank you. More than that, a bunch of people have been interested in my Aliyah experience, in part because they're interested in making Aliyah. And it's not uncommon when people are considering to make Aliyahs, you speak to people who have made Aliyah recently, because so many different things change in this country. Someone who made Aliyah more recently can give you a better lay of the land of the way things are now, as opposed to the way things might have been 10 years ago. But anyway, or even if it's not that, someone who has a similar background or experience might say, hey, what was your experience? What are things that I can learn from it? And another reason why I think, actually, I shouldn't say, I think one person in particular said she wanted my experience, my perspective, not my experience. She wanted my perspective on Aliyah in part because I have a habit of speaking my mind. It gets me into trouble a lot. Why that's important regarding Aliyah, and the stories is that I've noticed a really unfortunate tendency, among Aliyah activist people types who are very well-meaning, but can get incredibly harsh and defensive when people write about a negative experience in Israel. I know one friend of mine has been having a very difficult go of it, and people don't like hearing that. There's a sense sometimes where, oh, make Aliyah, everything's going to be perfect. This was, from what I remember from years back, kind of how B'nai Akiva used to sell Aliyahs. Making Aliyah will be the answer to all of your problems. Nefesh B'Nefesh, to their immense credit, takes a much more realistic approach where they will tell certain people, depending on the scenario, you're better off not making Aliyah right now. For example, let's say you're studying for some profession. There's a chance, but I know that on more than one occasion they'll tell people, finish your degree in America. I apologize. I'm going to focus on America. You know, I'm from New York. At least I'm talking about the whole country this time, but please excuse me for the U.S. centricity of my approach here. But anyway, they will tell people, hey, don't make Aliyah yet. Finish your degrees, get certifications or whatever, then make Aliyah. Because for Nefesh B'Nefesh, for as much as they want people to make Aliyah, my sense is that they want people, more important than making Aliyah, is staying in Israel. Anyone can fill out forms and take a flight over, but if you go back in a month or, you know, less or a year, however long, because you just weren't prepared, you know, better you just take your time and go so that you don't have to worry about coming back and whatever. But still, even among, I don't want to say Nefesh B'Nefesh types, but I still have noticed people get very defensive when they're critical about making Aliyah and having a difficult experience. One friend of mine I know has had a rough time, and people will say things like, what are you complaining about? You'd have that same problem in America. Nothing to do with Israel. Or maybe they'll say, hey, you're doing something wrong. Or some other stuff like that. Or just really ridiculous platitudes of, oh, sure, it's bad now, but things are going to get better. Now, even if any one of those statements are true, they're all entirely besides the point. The truth is, Israel is not an easy country in many respects. We'll talk a bit about that. Sometimes it's easier for some people than others, but it's not easy. And people are going to go through some difficult times. There are some things here which are, I don't want to say crazy, but certainly if you come from America, seem absolutely ridiculous. And people will pick up on some things more than others. Are they severe enough so that someone shouldn't make Aliyah? I don't know. That's up to you. But just because it might not be that high of a level to say, well, trying to issues with, say, your house, just to give one example, a friend of mine in Baca, living in an apartment, renting, the electrician came in and installed a heating unit in the bathroom, which is kind of how things work here. Some have central heating, some have these heating units. Some people use these rolling ones. Others have a unit built into the wall. And the person, the electrician, installed this heating unit in the bathroom, but actually in the area of the shower stall. And apparently when it, from what my friend said, when the inspector came, he said something like, Kasher avalobari, that this is technically permissible or technically okay according to the rules, but really unsafe. There are things like that that happen, and from my understanding is that's the norm, not the exception. Is it exclusive to Israel? I don't know. If you're coming from America, where in certain areas things are more misudar, they're more orderly, things that you expect more, yeah, it can be a bit jarring. And, again, I don't want to say that, because of these things, someone shouldn't make Aliyah. But at the same time, I think you have to really acknowledge that there are certain challenges here. And to outright dismiss them doesn't do anyone any good. If anything, it helps build up more resentment. Some people can laugh it off. Some people can't. Better to help people through, because being judgmental of others, I found, is not a very effective way of getting people to change their minds. Anyway, the real truth is here, every situation for making Aliyah is going to be different, because people are different, their situations that they're leaving are different, and the situations that they're coming to are different. And both of those, I think, are equally important when it comes to having a successful Aliyah that we'll talk about in a bit. A huge issue that I personally had with not Aliyah, but with people's attitudes towards Aliyah, is the tendency to be familiar with a couple of anecdotal stories, or might even include your own story, and assume that your story must be true or hold truths for everyone. This happens in many aspects of life, comes up a lot in dating, where here was my experience, so therefore this should be applicable to you. And it happens a whole lot with Aliyah. I can't tell you how many times I heard the story of that one radiologist who works a night shift in America, and kind of telecommutes and earns an American salary like that. Yeah, I'm sure that person, or maybe a couple of people, exist. But guess what? If you're not a really radiologist, that doesn't help you all that much. And usually people will point to these one or two examples and saying, well, this is what this person did and they made it. Like, yeah. And then there are a whole bunch of other stories where that didn't happen. Dating is another good example for this in Aliyah, where, said, oh, so-and-so moved to Israel and got married, which I've no doubt is true when someone tells me that story. But I also have plenty of friends who made Aliyah single and they're still single. What does that tell you? That there's absolutely no correlation between making Aliyah and getting married, right? Now, that should seem like an obvious point, except that's not the way a lot of people think. If you really want to get a good idea of how Aliyah works. You're going to need to know you're going to need to know the full story, and that means getting to know a bit about an individual's experiences. Because after all, every situation really is different in terms of, the things that, you might be giving up when you make Aliyah, whatever resources you have here, not to mention personal fortitude resources. Some people have better attitudes than others. Other people have more aptitude, in certain areas than others. So there really isn't a single story. And I think it's important to remember that, if you are considering Aliyah, you can speak to people, but at the end of the day, some things might parallel your experience, other things won't, and that's completely okay. I'd just be more concerned with, hearing a story and either for good or bad and assuming someone else's experiences are in fact going to be yours. So with that in mind, it's important to go back. And for those who don't know, or at least the first part of the story, why I made Aliyah, because this is actually very important for, I think, my experience on the whole. So many of you know I was working in the Stanton Street Shul on the Lower East Side of New York. I was there for 6 years. And at some point, I believe it was last January, a year ago in 2014, I got this letter that the cooperative, the co-op complex where I was renting, was raising their sublease fees. I don't know how common this is, but in this particular co-op, the landlords, if you owned an apartment and you wanted to rent it out to someone else, you had to pay a fee to the co-op for the right to rent your apartment. I think initially it was something like it's 100% of maintenance for a 1 year lease, 150% for a 2 year lease, and 200% for a 3 year lease, something like that. The maintenance happened to be incredibly low, in this particular co-op, so it might not seem that bad. However, they had raised this fee to the point where my landlord said that what I was paying in rent, which was by no means insignificant, wouldn't have covered the cost of those fees, let alone any profit to the owner. What that meant was it was going to be financially prohibitive to stay in that particular complex, and it would mean I would have to move. Problem is, even staying on the Lower East Side was getting more financially difficult. Just for some numbers, when I was looking around, the average one bedroom that I saw there at the time I was leaving was about $2,500 a month. That comes out to $30,000 a year in rent alone, which meant even if the shul would put up $40,000, and I'm only using this because the math is easy and $40,000 a year. If you're spending $30,000 on rent, that's like 75% of your salary just going to rent. And in my case, it's going to rent, to live in a neighborhood that's required for me to do the job that I was hired to do. That's not a very fiscally responsible position to be in. And it was also clear that the rents were rising faster than the shul would be able to keep up. And I felt guilty even asking for a cost of living increase, because the shul is not an affluent synagogue. There's not a whole lot of money there. They wonderful people, but there's only so much. It's a part-time position. And the rents were going to go up faster than they could, that they could compensate. And that money wasn't even going to go to me if I would ask for a raise. It would just go to landlords whom we're all very nice people, mind you, but it just seemed like a really bad situation. Buying was no better. The week before I cleared out of my apartment, one bedroom opened up on my floor. It was 780 square feet, and the initial asking price was $625,000 for a 780 square foot one bedroom apartment. So basically, once I got that notice from the co-op, they had rescinded it, about a month later. But once I got that notice, it really hammered home the point that for me and my personal situation, this was not going to be tenable for that much longer. If you're wondering how the shul manages now, both my predecessor and successor were married to professionals who probably, I have no idea how much money they made, but I would assume a lot more than a part-time rabbi job could have done. And making it on, you know, 1.5 salaries is a lot easier than making it on a half. So I knew that what I had going on wasn't going to last for that much longer. And I didn't really see they had that many other options available. For example, I had applied to computer jobs and couldn't find real steady computer work. I applied to PhD programs, didn't get in. Those are very competitive, but worth taking a shot, but didn't come through, so had to look for something else. I couldn't even, though, look for many other rabbi jobs, mostly because I'm not married, and in the pulpit world, it's very difficult for single unmarried rabbis to even get an interview, let alone get hired. And for other things like the Jewish Learning Initiative that the OU runs are specifically geared towards hiring a married couple, which is a little bit different in the sense that they interview the wife as well, and she's expected to be contributing member, and you're hired as a couple. But regardless of how they work, none of those positions were open to me at all. So change was inevitable. I couldn't stay put, again, for the financial constraints. So I had made a decision that when change was going to happen, if it was going to be inevitable, it made more sense to me to try to get out in front and make the change on my terms, or at least as much as possible. Even if I could have stretched out, you know, a year, maybe two, at the shul, at the end of those year or 2 years, I would not have been that much better off. It wouldn't have been, I mean, given how much was being spent on rent, it wasn't like there was, you know, that much I could really sock away. And yeah, it just seemed to try as much as you can. Didn't want to be behind the change, and figured if it's going to happen, do it sooner. And do it again. Well, not just sooner. I mean, sooner just makes it easier in terms of the transition. But being more prepared that it was going to happen, as opposed to, you know, waiting around and getting blindsided, you know, who knows when, and sort of be forced to and then scramble. The reason why this is important is because knowing that this is why I left can help explain what my mentality was in making Aliyah. So as the song goes, freedom is just another word for nothing left to lose. Because my status quo was ending, I never had that sense of loss or of giving up anything or of saying, I am making, you know, I'm, you know, this is fine and now I'm going to give this up to try something else. If the job was, you know, not going to be tenable, well, that would have involved a change. Wasn't giving up, you know, a fantastic apartment. It's not like I had a great house or a great deal on the rent. That was, you know, fine. It was a nice place, but nothing that, you know, says, you know, I'm tied here. And also the rest of my immediate family was in Israel. All of that meant there was nothing really holding me back in America. I didn't really have strong attachments, which meant there was nothing to give up, which meant there would be nothing to regret of the decision. And I think that's important because a lot of times when people make a decision that they later regret, it's because you've got more than one option and you decide one over the other, or you take a risk and you give up what you have now, a sure thing, for a possibility which may or may not come true. For me, the option wasn't really to stay. The things that were more in my choice involved the change, and I had no inherent obligations to keep me in America. So all of that helped with the optionality to say, well, if this is going to change, what can I do? What is in my hands? And it also meant I didn't make Aliyah. And I know this is going to sound, you know, really non-Zionist, but it's the truth here. Despite Nefesh B'Nefesh's slogan of live the dream, that wasn't really my attitude when I made Aliyah. Now, it's not to say that I haven't wanted to make Aliyah for a while, but there wasn't that sense of I am now completing some holistic life mission. Sorry about that. I'm not completing some, you know, life mission that, you know, this is going to complete me, or, you know, out of the sense of, you know, real Zionist idealism. That wasn't really my attitude there. And there wasn't a sense of, oh, I'm going to make Aliyah and now my life is going to be automatically better or somehow improved. Like, remember, I wasn't giving up anything. So because I wasn't giving up anything, I had no reason to put the burden of expectation of a better life onto Israel. And what that, it just seemed to me to be just another chapter in a long adventure. You know, there was a time I did this, that ended. Time I did that, that ended. So now let's try Israel and see what happens. So my attitude wasn't having expectations of what should happen, or, you know, what I would need to happen in order for me to be happy. But rather, it allows me to handle what does happen in the real world. And my approach had been, you know what? This is good and can always work to improve. Or to flip it around, working to improve while simultaneously realizing what I have now in whatever situation is fine. And working like that. This might not work for you. I understand some people really need, you know, the chizuk, the strength, and just the huge emotion of like, I'm making Aliyah, this is fantastic, I'm making a difference, doing what all Jews should be doing. And for some people, not only does that work, but that helps them get through the inevitable, you know, quirks that happen when you move to a foreign country in a totally different culture. But that wasn't really me. The mindset that I approached it with fit my circumstances a lot better. In addition to that, for my own mental disposition, was probably a lot healthier. Your mileage is going to vary, which is exactly my point. The situation that I had before I made Aliyah definitely impacted my approach to Aliyah when I got here. So yeah. That takes care of that side. There are a couple of other unique factors that are worth talking about. Many people have something extra when they make Aliyah. For some people, it could be wealthy relatives or in-laws. Someone you know in an apartment can give you a break on the rent. You might have connections. Not everyone has these, mind you. And I know people who have made Aliyah with none of this. So I happen to be very grateful for, you know, what I have and what the advantages, you know, whatever those are. And I'll talk about that in this part. One of them, in terms of also going back to the somewhat related to my own situation, I happen to be a low maintenance single guy. I don't need much and I don't have that many responsibilities. In fact, one reason why I didn't make Aliyah for many years was I used to be scared and intimidated of making Aliyah alone. You know, without support, without, you know, knowing people. Do people do it? Yes. And this goes back to the old, you know, thing. It's like, oh, you know, these people made Aliyah and they're happy. Very well and good. Had I done so years ago, probably would not have worked out that well based on where I was. Today, I'm actually a little grateful that in my making Aliyah, it really is only on me, all the responsibilities. And it seems scarier to me now to make Aliyah and to make these, you know, make such a huge leap when other people are actively depending on me, be it wife or children. You know, right now, I can, when I first made Aliyah, I didn't have to worry about how do I feed kids. I didn't have to worry about where am I going to send my kids to school? Are they going to adjust? I didn't have to worry about a spouse. Is she happy? How is she adjusting? Does she have a job? If, you know, a spouse or kids are having a rough time of it, that certainly makes Aliyah a whole lot more challenging. So for me, at my stage, this way seemed actually, you know, in a weird way, better once I sort of came to terms with that. For those who are saying, again, people make Aliyah when they're married and when they have kids, yes, that's not the point. Every situation is going to be different, and mine happens to involve low maintenance, and thankfully not that much in terms of responsibilities. Speaking of which, another huge advantage I had is that my parents already made Aliyah. They had been in Israel for about 2 years when I made Aliyah. And a couple of things there. One, get to catch up with them. For my time at the shul, I spoke to my parents regularly, you know, usually once, twice a week, on average, but didn't really have a chance to see them because they're busy with their lives and it's not like I could take off Shabbos to see them so often. So get to catch up after 6 years. Also incredibly helpful that I was able to stay with them when I got off the plane. In fact, I'm still staying with them now as I'm recording this, though I've been actively looking for places to rent. At any rate, you know, that, again, catch up on that a bit later. But for right now, it is a huge, huge relief to know that when you get off the plane, you have a place to stay. That takes a huge load off in terms of finding a place, finding a decent place, and also paying for it. Rent costs money in Israel just as it does in America. And in order to pay rent, you either need to do one of two things. You either dip into savings or you get a job. And the longer you are without a job, the more into your savings you will have to dip. So for me, that's been huge because yes, you know, it allows me to save a bit of money. More important for me, at least, is that it meant I didn't have the same immediate stresses that other people who make Aliyah need to find a place, need to have, you know, either, you know, a stockpile of savings in order to make their way through for the first, you know, however long it takes for them to get a job or to get a job immediately. And because I don't have a lease yet, I have a bit of flexibility in terms of where I wind up for computer jobs. I'll talk about the employment in a bit. Most of them are located north, or at least north of Jerusalem, I should say, in the Tel Aviv, Ranana, Herzliya area. So had I, you know, rented a place and committed to Jerusalem immediately and would have gotten a job elsewhere, that would, you know, lead to some really, really annoying commute. You know, so the main negative, you know, living in, you know, the current living situation is most of my stuff is in storage. I actually shipped my stuff. I went with a company called Sonigo. They're currently holding on to my stuff in long-term storage, I hope. The stuff came to Israel very quickly. It wasn't that much. It came out to 231 cubic feet. Those are all my worldly possessions. Happened to be mostly books. And of the furniture, just about all of it was foldable. The largest single piece that I had was a twin mattress, which, again, not that huge, but in terms of making those decisions, what to take and what not to take, it was more of the math of what might cost more here versus the shipping and all that. Everyone does their own cheshbon, their own calculations for those things. If anyone's interested, more than happy to talk about, you know, everyone privately based on their own situation. I will say this, though. Before I made Aliyah, this was a lot of fun. Most of my possessions are books. So I don't want to take all of the books that I had because as much as I like books, you know, I sort of have my own little metrics for evaluating books. There's read-worthy and there's shelf-worthy, meaning there's a book. You know, sometimes there's a book, oh, you should read this book, but, you know, you don't need to own it. It doesn't have to be there for reference because, after all, you own a book. You have to schlep it from place to place. You know, it also takes up room on a bookshelf, which costs money. Then, you know, every time you move, you have to take it with you. Is it worth taking it with you? And in my case, it was, is it ship worthy? Meaning, do I need this book enough that, you know, either I'm going to enjoy it or, you know, might be useful in the future that it's worth sending across the world? So I went through all my books, found a bunch that I wasn't going to use, and I had a Raid the Rabbi event where I put the books on a table, invited everyone from the community, special friends who I know are really big book geeks, and basically said, take whatever you want. So those, you know, those people helped me out immensely, you know, by taking books that I just wasn't going to take with me anyway, because it just would have been too much. And I got to make friends happy. So wins all around. Anyway, what was I saying? Right. So since I've made Aliyah, I've been effectively living out of the two suitcases that I took with me when I made Aliyah. We were entitled to, if I'm remembering correctly, two bags of 70 pounds each, something like that. And I got these wonderful rolling duffel bags from eBags that were just fantastic, stored a whole lot of stuff. So I just packed stuff in there, and that's what I've been using since I've made Aliyah for 6 months. I guess that just meant I packed intelligently. But again, low maintenance single guy, I'm completely okay with that. One thing that I felt I was missing from the shipment was my guitar, because I just wasn't able to practice. So I actually did pick up one, relatively inexpensive one in this country. Also in America too, it's one on the cheaper end. And that way I've just been able to get back to practicing. So that's been fine. So the one thing that I felt, oh, you know, I really miss this, I was able to replace. So yay. Another huge advantage that I have was, in addition to my parents being here, my sister is here. My sister and brother-in-law made Aliyah back in 2002. They were on the very first Nefesh B'Nefesh flight. And they made Aliyah without the family support that I have. And they figured a whole lot of stuff out. Their Aliyah has been really spectacular. Both my sister and brother-in-law work very talented, work really hard, and many respects got very lucky, which is nice to see, you know, when people who are smart and work hard also get lucky. Put all that together, they seem to be going pretty well, and they've worked out a whole lot of things. So they've been incredibly helpful with Aliyah advice and for giving different perspectives, because they work to figure all this stuff out, and I don't have to. So that's fantastic. Plus, also another great place to stay, you know, for Chagim and the like. And also more family. And family's nice. Well, let me rephrase that. Family's nice if you get along. I should have added that as a nice little perk there. It's not just that, you know, I'm fortunate enough to have, you know, my parents that host me, I'm fortunate enough to have a healthy enough relationship with my parents that doing so isn't, you know, mentally traumatic. You know, look, I'm aware that not everyone gets along with their parents, both of them, or, you know, or even one of them. We seem to be managing okay. Not to say that, again, I'm looking to stay here full time. And the truth is, I think that that's actually makes things easier, because both I know and my parents know that I'm actively looking to find my own place, and I'm not just content to hang around here. I think that makes it easier for for everyone. So what were things like in terms of sequence, how things happened when I got off the plane? So the first week after making Aliyah, I was in what I called paperwork mode, because there are a lot of things to fill out. Some of the paperwork we actually took care of on the plane. Nefesh B'Nefesh did, excuse me, a fantastic job with this, where we filled out some forms or something. They were in business class and worked the entire flight filling out the governmental paperwork so that it would be ready when we landed. There was a bit of a Tekka celebration type thing, which they had actually canceled the one before the previous flight's one, because that summer was a bit of, let's say, war with Gaza, for lack of a better term. So they actually had one for mine. It was fine. You know, got to see people, all good times had by all. At the end, had to fill out some paperwork, you know, there too, signing up for things, all good. Then there were other things like getting a bank account, health insurance. Nefesh B'Nefesh was incredibly helpful in this regard. They've got some really, really good literature on, you know, all the things that you need to take care of, and in some ways providing order for it. Really, really helpful. 3 months in, I got what's called a Tu'udat Ma'avar, which is kind of like a passport. I think you get the passport if you're here, or you can get a passport if you're here for a year. Maybe if you haven't left the country, I don't know all of those rules. But I got the Tu'udat Ma'avar just in case an emergency happened, I'd have to lose the country. There was a bit of an excitement where somewhat early on, I had lost my wallet. which, you know, I hadn't lost a wallet in a long time. Apparently this is normal, though. Not losing wallets, although in our family, losing stuff kind of is. There's a book called The Organized Mind by Daniel Levitin, who actually writes about when you're in a brand new situation, it's much more mentally taxing because so many of the actions that you do as a matter of habit, you now have to think about a lot more. And you've got a lot more alertness and awareness, which means your brain focus is shifting from, you know, the mundane things that you took for granted, too mundane things that you took for granted, which means goes away from other stuff. So that was kind of annoying because, among other issues, it sort of slowed down my ability to get a driver's license. That's somewhat of an involved process here. I haven't finished it yet, but working on that. It's just a little bit harder now that I'm working. Anyway, because I didn't have financial obligations, I didn't have to dip into savings, didn't have to pay rent, I was able to do Ulpan. For those unfamiliar, Ulpan is a benefit that new immigrants get, basically free Hebrew classes. I did Beit Ha'am. It's located in the center of Jerusalem, was very easy to get to from where I am. Studied with this guy, Alex, who is really fantastic, just brilliant, brilliant guy. Also, he had similar senses of humor, not in the sense that, you know, he told bad puns, but we were able to riff off each other every now and again. I enjoyed it very much. I decided to sign up for 5 days a week from 8:30 to 1. The Ulpan thing is something where you're entitled to a certain number of hours. And I know Beit Ha'am has some 5 days a week and some are 2 days a week and, you know, whatever. And if you do it 2 days a week, obviously you'll be able to do it for, you know, many more weeks, because you're just entitled to more hours. Reason why I did the 5 days a week from 8 to 1 was that I wanted to treat it like a job until I found a job. It was a way of getting more acclimated to, Aliyah, not just from learning the language, but just getting into a healthier routine. So I just wasn't lounging around the place, you know, wake up at 11, you know, do whatever. Just wanted to focus on this is going to be my job. Another huge perk that came from doing it 5 days a week was you get to know the people in the Ulpan a lot better because you're seeing them every day. And once you get to know the people in the Ulpan, the conversations become a lot more fun because you get to know people's personalities. I should also add here in terms of, like, you know, Ulpan, some people were, you know, were perplexed. You know, why do you need an Ulpan? Aren't you a rabbi? The truth is there are very different skills. The ability to, you know, read a piece of Gemara is very different than the ability to order from a menu. When I first came to Israel, I didn't know what the Hebrew word for menu is. It happens to be tafrit. But I didn't know that because I'm just not used to speaking modern Hebrew. There are things I can understand, but even when I took a Hebrew shiur at YU, it's actually how I wound up with Rav Ben Chaim as a Rebbe, where YU at the time, I don't know what's there now, had only two shiurim that were given in Hebrew. One was Rabbi Goldwicht and the other is Rabbi Ben Chaim. I thought I'd like Rabbi Ben Chaim a little bit better. I thoroughly enjoyed the class, but even there, yes, it's in Hebrew, but you're talking about halachic concepts, which you're going to know, well, hopefully at that point anyway. But how to get around day to day? Much harder. To be able to converse, you know, without stuttering, those take, you know, that takes time if you don't have that sort of fluency. So, yes, I happen to be a rabbi. I, you know how to read Hebrew. I know a whole bunch of words. But in order to get around to have conversations with people, the Ulpan was something I'm very grateful I was able to do. And I say that because I know not everyone is able to do the Ulpan, largely because of financial reasons or, you know, other assorted things. There was someone in my Ulpan dropped out because, you know, she needed to earn money. That happens. Doesn't make you a bad person. It's just the situation you have, and you got to just adjust with whatever you got to deal with. So I mentioned a bit about the job, and this is also worth talking about because people have some weird expectations about jobs. It's, oh, you'll find a job in no time. I know someone who was upset that Nefesh B'Nefesh didn't find him a job. Nefesh B'Nefesh doesn't do that. They do have some job counseling. They do have some job networking. But Nefesh B'Nefesh isn't an employment agency. And they might be looking out for you, but don't expect them to find you a job such that if they don't, you know, it's shayach. I see I'm even blanking on my English now. it's not fair to blame them if you don't find employment. So this one might be a little bit more, specialized here. But when I made Aliyah, my plan was to get adjusted in my first year here. What that meant was looking more for computer jobs than anything rabbinic or even academic. Because I know people who make Aliyah and go straight into PhD programs. I thought that would have been too much for me, even if I, could have gotten in. With the rabbi jobs, apparently Israel has a bunch of rabbis. So finding places would be difficult. And even if there's an opening, my Hebrew is not nearly good enough to be a rav of an Israeli-speaking community. I actually gave the Dvar Torah once at the minyan where my parents daven I think it's technically Baca. It's called the Beit Boyer. And what would have taken me maybe 20 minutes to put together in English took several hours and many revisions for an 8-minute Dvar Torah. And everything had to be written out. And that was, it was painful. It was hard. I like to think it was worthwhile. For anyone's interested, I actually posted it on Utopia on joshuter.com. Forgetting the title of it, but it happens to be all in Hebrew. That was not an easy thing to do. So I don't think I'd be able to do that for a Hebrew-speaking community. And for English-speaking communities, well, there are even fewer of those. And even if you do find those, the rabbinate's not a real profession where you just, you're going to earn a living out of that. Probably even less so in Israel than in America. It's a very different mentality. The only way that I'd be able to do that is if somehow I found an incredibly affluent Anglo-speaking community. I'm sure those exist, but I'm pretty sure that they all have rabbis and the competition would be kind of nuts. Not to mention I'd have to deal with the whole not being married issue, although I'm not sure if that's an issue here for the pulpit. There's also, the yeshiva system of the post-college ones. That is an absolutely crazy system where I've got no connections in and it's very difficult not only to get jobs. I don't even know about keeping jobs, but most people I know of in that profession teach in multiple places, because not many pay a full living wage. There's very little room for advancement. If you ask too much, you just get fired or your contract not renewed or however it works here. And they bring in someone else who's younger who'll work cheaper. The only way you can really advance is if you open up your own yeshiva. That doesn't always work. Anyway, I did not want to be part of that world, at least for relying on any sort of income or adjusting. If it ever comes up where yeshiva, says, hey, we have an opening for something, you want to give shiur every now and again, I would be so honored and thrilled to do that. But for regular professional, didn't seem to make sense. And seminaries, completely out of the question. Last I heard, and there may be exceptions to this, seminaries for women aren't going to be so keen on hiring single guy teachers. That's at least in one of the discriminations I cannot argue with at all. That makes total sense. Again, there might be exceptions, but those were not things that I could work on or rely on. So it seemed to be the most responsible thing to look in the tech industry, because after all, Israel's got a whole bunch of tech companies, Startup Nation and all that. Not to mention, some big established companies also have offices here. And I spoke to contacts who were incredibly helpful from all across the board. But I did have a few challenges with that too. The first one being, I hadn't worked professionally as a programmer for 6 years. I did a bunch of stuff for the Stanton Street Shul, which was certainly helpful for keeping up on things, but, people see through. I was like, oh, okay, fine. You've got some experience. You kept up with it, but that wasn't your real job. that's fair. The other thing was that I noticed people like specialization here. So forgive me if I get a bit technical. I'll try to, you know, try to explain this. Let's say you're dealing with web programming. Web programming usually involves two major components. The front end, referring to how does the web page look, like what's presented to the user. Excuse me, that involves HTML, CSS, JavaScript programming, that stuff. And backend, things that usually take place on the server side. Depending on how big the application, you might even have a middle tier, you know, where you could have like, you've got let's say SQL programming for a database, some intermediate language that handles it, and a server side, and the client, you know, going to the client side. This is just how it works. So most of the jobs that I had in computers in America involved multiple aspects. So I worked on front end, back end, middle tier, whatever was necessary. Here, the attitude that I got was, well, that wasn't really a front end job. And if you applied for a front end job, and that was it, there was a much greater focus on technical specialization that I found kind of working against me, because like the fact that I had back end experience somehow meant I wasn't a good front end programmer, which is absolutely absurd. What isn't absurd is, well, the tech advanced a lot in the past 6 years. So I ordered a book, you know, to try to catch up on, you know, a lot of the tech that I missed. Like when I left the field, jQuery, I don't want to say if it didn't exist, but no one was really doing it. There were a whole bunch of other things I just didn't know that, like, well, might as well teach myself that. But at any rate, it was a bit of a challenge. On the plus side, the people I spoke to, at least on the phone, seemed genuinely impressed that anyone, you know, not only someone making Aliyah, but someone who made Aliyah during a very difficult period. So it was nice to at least, you know, get that sense of camaraderie with people. I did, however, manage to get employed, and like most of the cooler things that have happened in my life, wasn't something that I actually sought out for or applied. It kind of fell in my lap, mostly through connections. And there were a lot of things that gave me pause about it. The big one being, the job was for C#, which isn't intrinsically bad. It's just I had absolutely no experience in the language. But it was close enough to Java. And like every programming job you're going to find out there, you're going to have a technical test, because anyone can put on their resume, oh, I know Java, I know jQuery. Everyone's going to give you a test to show, well, do you really know this? So I had a technical proficiency test, did well enough to actually earn the job based on merits, still employed, you know, so I haven't gotten fired yet. So hopefully from their side, it's fine. And it's a really good company. You know, we're doing interesting I'm working on interesting problems, good tech, and really, really great people. It's a company where I'm not sure how much I'm actually allowed to talk about it because of NDAs, and I'm not the marketing person, so I don't want to give anyone the wrong impression. But I can say this, you know, it's a startup where I understand what they're trying to do. I've met a lot of people in the startup world, especially from the Lower East Side and, you know, the tech stuff. And sometimes people have explained to me, you know, either companies or ideas. And part of me felt like, well, that's a nice idea, but why would anyone give you money for this? Apparently people do, which is why I'm not a multimillionaire, because I don't understand this world. But at least the company I'm working for now, yeah, I get what they're doing and I understand why. It's also not an unethical company, which I know that seems like a weird thing to say, but I had interviewed for a place that wasn't doing anything illegal, but it was certainly sketchy, and this was inherently part of their business model. I'm not going to get into any more details, and, you know, a place like that was really, really, you know, like, thought about, do I really want to be doing this? And the answer was no. Fortunately, again, because of the lack of immediate financial pressures, I didn't have to take the first job that came by, where I wasn't holding out like, oh, you know, I'm, you know, worth more. It's like, I can do this. There's something better out there. Was this doesn't seem right. Let me hold off until something seems that it's right. So right now, working for a particular company, which has also required a bunch of adjustments. On the Lower East Side, I pretty much worked from home. Now I've got an hour and a half commute each way. The first time I did the commute, it took 2 hours because I'm living in Jerusalem in a neighborhood called Arnona, and the job is in Modi'in. So what that means is I have to get myself from Arnona to the central bus station just to take a Sheirut, a van service, to get to Modi'in. The first day I did the bus, and the bus is a lot longer. I think the buses took about twice as long as doing the Sheirut. So yeah, we don't do that anymore. And at least now I'm looking for, right now I'm looking for places to live, in Yerushalayim, though closer to, the central bus station to cut down on the commute. And we'll see what happens with that. It's a weird time. They're weird times. Like everything, you've got a real estate market that's, sometimes you're busier than others. And again, the fact that I'm not forced to take the first thing that comes along my way, it really helps a lot. Also, I haven't worked a full-time office schedule since before I was working in the synagogue. And for as many hours I put at the synagogue, there was be here, be there, just not like, oh, I have to be at this place at this time every day. It's an adjustment. One of the big things that you find people having to adjust to is the lack of Sundays. Here, Friday is your day off. Or I should say your day off in addition to Shabbat. And that you're mostly spending, prepping for Shabbat. I refer to Sunday's Shabbat Sheni Shel Galiot, which maybe you get it, maybe you don't. Not that funny either way. So that takes care of the job stuff. Dating. A bunch of people have been asking me about dating, or at least my experiences in dating so far in Israel. I'm not going to talk about that in great detail as much as saying, in many respects, it's the same as it was before, where I happen not to, I don't like a lot of the blind setups for a whole bunch of reasons. That's just a personal thing. But that is less to do with Israel than it does to do with me. So it's not a function of, here's what, Israeli girls are like, or here's what, women who made Aliyah are like, none of that. The dating thing has nothing to do with Israel. It's more about me. That sounded incredibly self-centered. Any issues behind it are more mine. Anyone's interested in my thoughts on, I actually guest blogged for JDate for 3 months. So if anyone's interested, you can check out their blog and see an archive of some stuff I wrote for them. Anyway, it's going on for this for a while. So let's wrap things up here. Basically, the status after 6 months is, things are just fine. In terms of good or bad, it's hard to say. Could things be better? Absolutely. Could things be worse? You bet. And everything is subject to change. Both apartment, both job, not unlike any other place. It's just I'm wired in such a way now that I'm more embracing that nothing is permanent. Everything can change. Appreciate what I have, try to look to, do things, try to look to improve, however that may be, explore whatever options are there, take whatever shots you can, and if, even if things don't work out the way you'd like, how do you make what you got the best that it can be? That, isn't so much a lesson for Israel as it is for maybe other aspects of life too, but it certainly has helped me a lot. And that's been pretty much where things have been in the first 6 months. If there's interest or if people like this one, I'll probably do a Aliyahversary podcast. But after that, I don't know. If you're really that interested in my personal life, let me know. And I'm sure I can do more if there's interesting stuff that happens. But the truth is, once you got a 9-to-5 day job, life gets a lot more boring. The main advantage I have one of the better things I have with the job, for at least with the commute, as annoying as it can be, is I get to do a lot of reading. So that's fun. That might not be a bad idea to a Utopia Book of the Month Club thing. But anyway, that just seems to be what Israel is now. And in many respects, it's not unlike living in America in terms of the big questions. And in terms of the small question, you know, the small stuff, it really depends. You know, you got to deal with the reality you have and adjust accordingly. And in that respect, it really is no different than America. Are things going to be annoying at times? Absolutely. And don't pretend that those things don't exist and they aren't going to happen. But it is something to keep in mind. And adjust with it as you can. And I have no idea, you know, if you're listening to this, what your deal breakers might be. I can say that people on the whole do at least try to be supportive, because whatever you're going through, someone else has gone through it too. And I forget who said this, but someone related to my Aliyah thing said that Aliyah is a team sport. And you kind of get that sense. I happen to be very fortunate that I've got my family that I can rely on. But even if you don't have family here, I don't think it's too hard to find someone, you know, sympathetic ear who's gone through the same things, might, you know, will know what you're going through and will be able to help you out. And in that respect, you know, there are very few countries, you know, there are very few countries that are as welcoming to new immigrants as Israel is, at least to returning Jews, through the right of return. And that's, you know, something that makes Israel, I think, very special from an objective standpoint. And, you know, once you're here, you'll be able to complain about everything they do and actually be able to, you know, partake in the whole process here. Like, I've been here for 6 months and already I get to vote next month because the government collapsed, and we'll see how long this next one lasts. So, more fun stuff to come along the way. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. I hope this was interesting, maybe a little bit helpful. Feel free to leave comments below or let me know what you think privately. Have a wonderful day. Be well.